Either way.
Okay. I think everybody is here. This is for our discussion of ruptural transformation. I am delighted to discover the amount of revolutionary fervor that remains alive in the hearts of critical intellectuals, both in North America and in South America, sharing a deep skepticism in my gloomy view about the prospects for ruptural transformation. So I know that to some extent it's part of the dialectic of writing about writing comments is that you try to express skepticism about what you're writing, but still it's I'm very pleased that people resist the view that ruptural transformations are really not plausible, at least if we envision them as both democratic in their process and democratic in their outcomes. Now, I really enjoyed, you know, it's not because I'm a glutton for punishment. I enjoyed reading these and engaging them. The number of pages of our interrogations is gradually getting longer. This was 24 single-spaced pages by the time all of them were done. But in reading through these, it seemed, in a way, less useful to break down the interrogations into a particular set of distinct agendas, because there was so much overlap and intersection in the concerns that people raised. And I thought that perhaps we could try a somewhat different protocol for how we proceed today, which is that we just begin with the first of the interrogations and go through them one by one as far as we get. This also has the nice feature of providing a certain reward for people who get them in early, because their interrogations are towards the front of the pack. Now, I hope this doesn't create an incentive for people to get them in late, because they don't want their interrogation discussed. So we'll see if there are perverse consequences of this change.
Or hidden agendas if you do get it in late, so you try to quicken the discussion.
Oh, that's true too. So what my thought was this, that we'll begin with Ricardo's. And what I will do for each of them as we do it is ask the person who prepared the interrogation to remind us about its central themes. You could read through it. That's not necessary, though. It's just characterize what your argument is. And then we'll move on to the next after we've discussed it for a while. We can, of course, in the course of things, skip some. That is, if the main themes of a particular interrogation have already been thoroughly discussed, it's fine to then just move on to the next. And that shouldn't be taken as a rejection of the interest in a particular student's contribution. That would just be the natural flow of our discussion. Okay, we're all...
Okay. So, there is some people missing. I think Ricardo is among them. So Ricardo is not there, right?
No.
I don't know if he will come later.
Okay, so we can start with Catherine's then. Yeah, so we'll start with Catherine's, and then if Ricardo comes later, we can go back to his.
I guess one of the things I want to talk about comes closer to the end of my interrogation, relates a bit to the concept of rupture, and
sure,
also to your response of what it was. Mm-hmm. And I had a few problems with the concept, because I had a problem with the concept of, what was that called? Limited rupture? No.
Partial rupture.
Partial rupture. And wondering, like, what is a partial rupture? And then the comments Eric gave me also made me think of rupture. How do we evaluate rupture? Is it just in terms of the opportunity, or also in terms of the consequences for what you rebuild afterwards? And whether, so you can if the idea of rupture is demolished first and then build later, to me that implies an opportunity and not what comes out of it. because you can demolish first and rebuild the same thing later. If you build the same thing, it's not a rupture. Even if you start by demolishing it. Those things, I guess, that are odd. And then thinking of the demolishing and rebuilding sort of made me question how, if you're a state and you're actually supporting some, like, even democratic push towards a change, how ruptural it really is, even if it's... Because if you have a strong support for something, it implies that the institution which exists isn't really solidly interlinked with society. And then rupture, it's not ruptured in the same way as in you're building something radically different. You're just sort of getting rid of something that doesn't fit your society anymore and making something that does fit your society. And in the sense that that's compatible with society, it's not really ruptural.
So let me first just restate, but maybe with some slightly different words, how I'm thinking about the problem. And then we can think about this last point, which is a kind of paradox, I think. But let me first just explain what I'm trying to get at with rupture. I wanted to use the word rupture rather than revolution, partially because there's all this baggage that comes with the word revolution. So revolution could be, and indeed is, one of the central methods of rupture. But I didn't want the word, I wanted a word that wasn't itself the method. It was just saying what happened. In principle, then, you could have a reformist rupture, so to speak. That is, I wanted a concept that would make that not a logical impossibility, but it may be a logical impossibility, not just a sociological one. At any rate, the term rupture means a break and disjuncture in the character of the system in question, so that there is a clear disjuncture in some of the fundamental properties of the system in question. The formula, smash first, then build, is a way of capturing that idea. The discontinuity means there's a temporally very compressed period within which the change occurs. It doesn't literally mean smash first, build second. I don't think a complete demolition of all institutional features has to occur and be complete before anything new is built. You know, that's a kind of poetic way of emphasizing the discontinuity. But it is meant to suggest some really major break and discontinuity in the nature of the system in question. The notion of partial rupture is kind of hedging, I think, and I'm not sure if that's a coherent idea. The notion of a system rupture where you very rapidly destroy the centers of power that dominated the society and create an alternative. That's what, of course, revolutions attempt to do. That, I think, we understand what the meaning of disjuncture means in that larger sense. If we think about it as partial ruptures, or ruptures in particular institutional clusters, then we can still use the word, of course. You could describe a situation, for example, I use the illustration of healthcare in my comments. You know, you could describe a healthcare system that moves from a private market-centered system with some state-supported subsystems, as in the United States. Well, you could imagine that a left-wing egalitarian party wins with an election with sufficient popular support that they simply, in one move, eliminate the private market in healthcare and create a public system. And they pass a law that says private health insurance simply cannot be used to pay for healthcare. And from now on, it will be a publicly funded system. That would be a clear disjuncture. Mm-hmm. as opposed to we're going to build up a parallel state system that will gradually displace the private system because of the advantages it will have. And over time, the system will transform from a market-centered to a state-centered or society-centered system. So the abruptness of the dismantling of one system and the erection of the other is what I'm trying to get at with rupture. So perhaps it could be applied to a particular institution. And one would imagine if you did it like that between one day and the next, so to speak, in the healthcare system, it would be disruptive in the healthcare system. There would be a transition trough in healthcare because there would be difficulty in getting things paid for and having the system fully integrated for a period, although in that case I think the transition could be weathered. Yeah.
I guess that was sort of my reflection in thinking about that comment, is like that sort of rupture just seems like bad management. Or like in that case, unless there's a reason why you have to go all or nothing right now in the healthcare system. And I think there could be contexts when that is the case, but otherwise it just seems like, you know, even like if you're a democratically elected party and you have majority support, the chances of you not being able to carry out a 6-month plan or a year plan, if that's what it takes, are sort of low, like are quite low. So in the case of a partial rupture, it just seems.
But you're defining anything else as non-ruptural, right? as some other strategy of transformation. So I mean, any law at some point changes from one minute to the next, or one. I mean, at some point the law enters into effect, right? And so any law that says that private health insurance will no longer be allowed to used to finance provision of medical care is going to enter in a ruptural way. The question is how much legwork is done before the law actually comes into effect, right? So you're just kind of definitional issue. You're saying anything else which we prepare in advance for this particular moment, well, that's not ruptural, right?
This isn't capturing what's in play here. I mean, the transition trough between capitalism and socialism actually doesn't imply, contrary to what I just said, that on Thursday the state announced that there was no longer capitalism. That's not the point. It's that on Thursday they announced we are now launching a process that's going to culminate in socialism, in a fundamental discontinuity in the nature of the system. And there's going to be some period of time in which we are going to take over the banks and take over the factories. There'll be an orderly process if this is being done through a democratic state. There'll be an orderly process. It will be announced what that process is. There'll be some strategy in the course of that for dealing with all sorts of logistical problems that get that arise. But the end state of a complete transformation of the foundations of the system is clearly present in the entire... Whoops, did we lose them?
Yeah.
We're so lucky we have you keeping an eye on them.
Okay, we're back.
Yeah.
We're back.
Yeah.
Okay. We're back, okay. You missed the most important part of the discussion in that brief interlude where silence was all you heard.
Eric conceded that the revolution was in fact possible.
But still will not be televised.
So, the ruptural idea is the clear presence of a break with the system set in motion. When I say it's condensed in time, what I mean is that it's present in the strategic moment. And of course it can take several years, whatever is the process of this transformative project. In the case of a ruptural transition from capitalism to socialism, whatever the details of that dismantling of capitalism and creation of a socialist alternative would be, it would trigger, the argument is, disinvestment, capital flight, and indeed once the writing was on the wall, it would trigger all that. It doesn't have, you don't have to wait till a Thursday, so to speak, when the laws are announced. And that's why there's a transition trough, because partially there's a transition trough because of the reaction of powerful actors under the existing system to the threat of that transition, to the threat of that rupture. And then it just takes a long time. It's not a simple process to reintegrate the system under alternative principles. When the system is big and complex and highly differentiated the way a large developed capitalist economy is. So I guess the main idea of the rupture is the planned discontinuity in the system, planned in the sense of politically set in motion.
And the idea of a limited rupture would be not a rupture that is holistic of the entire society, but in some sense incomplete, but in more like a sectoral.
A sectoral.
Yeah.
So maybe the a better term would be sectoral rupture, because that's more what I have in mind, as opposed to a rupture in one particular element of the system.
Yeah.
I think it is really, it's a sectoral rupture, which therefore might be a better term for that.
Yeah, where the state could be a sector also.
Right.
But because we're talking about, because of the assumption that this is within the context of the social democratic, I mean, it seems like you've also sort of defined out radical changes in the structure of the state, unless I've misunderstood. It just seems like you've said, well, this has to be sort of a democratic process, which I agree with. But that kind of implies that the institutions which enable the democratic process are themselves continuing to exist throughout the rupture.
No, the democracy of those institutions could be deepened. There's nothing, for example, there's nothing in the argument of ruptural transformation that uses the democratic state in a democratic way that means it can't do things like in Porto Alegre, that is, create all sorts of participatory mechanisms and councils and at different levels of government that would be an additional form of democracy, and indeed shift responsibilities from the centralized representative institutions to the more participatory ones as part of the transition to a socially empowered economy, since one of the pathways of social empowerment is precisely directly involved with deepening the democratic character of the state. So the ruptural strategy would necessarily include the transformation of the state itself.
But are there transition troughs? I mean, was there a transition trough in when they implemented the participatory budgeting in Porto Alegre? I mean,
the transition trough that comes from the assault on capitalist property, right? That's where the transition
right.
comes
so,
from.
So
insofar as you're engaged in a deepening of the democracy of the state in ways that doesn't threaten capital, because it's just that one leg of that, you know, there's that diagram where there's social power and state power. It's the state power and economic power connection that threatens capital, not the social power, state power connection, except insofar as that gets translated into a relationship to the economy.
But then how do we determine, like, things like Porto Alegre? Was that reformist or ruptural? Because I think you could easily, if you're like, oh, this is a good step to, like, it all depends on what context you're visualizing it. And that's often an argument between radicals and reformists is that reformism doesn't go enough, but at the same time they often argue
right.
that it's taking you one step closer.
So the way I would describe the Porto Alegre case is that the actors at the time of its creation mm-hmm. envisioned it as the first step of a ruptural strategy. That is, they used the language of dual power, for example. That's an old ruptualist, revolutionary Marxian conception. So they envisioned it as the first step of a ruptural strategy, which became a symbiotic strategy. Mm-hmm. That is, it became a strategy, as we will discuss in a couple of sessions, which harnessed social empowerment in a way that solved system-level problems under the domination of capital. It made Porto Alegre capitalism work better than it did before, and solved social problems as it did. That is, it was a problem-solving context, but in a way that also enhanced social power. So it created it changed the hybrid. The hybrid of capitalist and socialist elements became, the socialist elements became stronger because of this new form of social power in the local state. It was able to be stabilized under those conditions because it had high problem-solving capacity. Reduced corruption, it made the city work better, reduced some social tensions, and so on. And that's what symbiotic strategies do. As we'll see, I prefer the term symbiotic to reform, because not all reforms are symbiotic. That is, some reforms just make changes that might be good for people, but they don't enhance social power at all. They just, do something nice that people like, but they're not social empowering. The idea of a symbiotic reform or transformation is one which solves some kind of problem in such a way that it also enhances social power. And that's why it's a strategy of transformation towards socialism, as I've elaborated it, or potentially a strategy for it.
But then that could, I guess the distinctions are hard to understand, because there's no reason why a symbiotic strategy couldn't also be within the perspective of ruptural outcome.
Yes, and as we'll also see next week when we discuss interstitial strategies, one vision of interstitial strategies is that they make possible successful rupture. So the idea in that perspective is that the accumulation of interstitial transformations, building new institutions in the cracks of the old, is to make possible the final leap towards a new system, which would be a break, not just a gradual transformation. So at some point, a break is needed, but the possibility of actually accomplishing that rather than just attempting it depends upon the prior success of interstitial strategies. That vision then sees the articulation of interstitial and ruptural strategies as the kind of meta-strategy for transformation. What you were just suggesting would see symbiotic strategies and ruptural strategies as a kind of meta-strategy, using symbiotic strategies as to set the stage for ruptural strategies. Yeah.
But even if in the analysis you can clearly distinguish between those, I mean, in historical examples, even if they were not in developed stable democracy, any ruptural strategy also brings symbiotic strategies or any of the other more gradual processes in mass activism or democratization, income distribution. It's not that someday a vanguard says, okay, let's overthrow the system. Like, it's a process which involves also other kinds of more gradual processes. Or not? I mean, do you see them as contradictory, or in a historical process? I mean, it could be more messed up.
I do think that all of these occur, and any actual ruptural strategy will have interstitial and symbiotic characteristics. But nevertheless, I think we could make a distinction between a classical revolutionary vision, which says you must seize power and break the power of the dominant class before you can make any serious headway on interstitial and symbiotic transformations, because if you don't break that power, then the ruling class will ultimately just undo any symbiotic or interstitial strategies you might adopt. So Marx, for example, in his critique of anarchism, in his fight with Bakunin and his rejection of workers' co-ops. So workers' co-ops are an example of interstitial transformation, right? So you live in a capitalist economy. The rules of the game of capitalism allow a bunch of workers to get together if they can get the capital to set up a firm in which they produce under democratic and egalitarian conditions. There's nothing in capitalism that says you can't do that. The problem is workers don't have the capital. But it turns out to be possible, even in Marx's day, for some workers to manage to get enough capital through savings or other means to set up a co-op. And the anarchists, with Bakunin as a sort of theoretician, saw that as the way to create the possibility of social... So actually, it's more with Proudhon I'm thinking about, not Bakunin. The Bakunin fight is later. This is the Proudhon fight, much earlier in the 1840s. So Proudhon said, form co-ops, proliferate co-ops, and co-ops will ultimately destroy capitalism because workers will defect from capitalist firms to cooperative firms, and the cooperative firms will be just as efficient and be able to outcompete capitalist firms in the long run because they'll have the commitments of workers behind them. And Marx initially was extremely hostile to this strategy. He softened a little bit over time. The initial hostility was, this is a complete sideshow. This is an illusion. It's a waste of time, and if workers put their energies into that, they will never succeed because they will abandon the revolutionary path. They will not be able to challenge capital, and these co-ops are just going to fail anyway. That was the harsh initial reaction. Later, he said, there's a place for co-ops. They do prefigure an alternative form of organization, but they will just reach limits, and we need the collective power of workers to overthrow those limits. So that, you know, that's a less hostile view, although I still think even then, I mean, I don't know the history that well, but I think it was still, even in that later, somewhat softer rhetoric around it, he felt that it was a distraction from building a true international working class organization and political party, just because it would be a displacement of energy and resources to this other purpose. But the Proudhon Bakunin type argument was that you would build these new institutions in the old, and then you'd smash the system, have a break. The Marxist view, Marx's view is you first had to really shatter the power of the ruling class, and then you could build co-ops. So there is a sequencing issue, which I think, which is what I'm trying to capture by characterizing the Ruckschel strategy in this kind of purer kind of form.
It seems pretty clear at the meta level and the system-wide level between rupture, symbiotic, and interstitial. It's that when you're talking about the limited ruptures is where it becomes, you know, from a, depends on the level of abstraction that you're talking about, right? From the level of a specific sector, you can have a ruptural strategy that's a part of an overall interstitial strategy,
yeah,
right?
I think I may drop that.
You can do it, I think, but it's...
That was quick. There's a brief little interruption as pizzas just got delivered. So, but we will not let this impede the intensity of our
the revolution
of the revolutionary discussion.
The just revolution be, comes in a box. None of us thought the box could be so small.
Okay.
And Ricardo already got there. If you want.
I don't have any plates.
Can we go to the faculty lounge? The staff lounge and all the
plates. So,
It's okay, it's still vegan.
What did they do?
He was really confused by mushroom versus just vegetarian or veggie pizza, so we have one complete just vegetable pizza, and then one half cheese with mushroom, and then one half vegan with just lots of vegetables.
Oh, we have to return it.
No, it's fine.
It's
fine.
As long as you don't mind variety, but
it'll be fine. It'll be fine. Okay, Ricardo, the way we're proceeding this time is to go through the interrogations one at a time, rather than through an agenda. And we started with Catherine's. I think we should we move on. Move back to. Were there other things on yours that you wanted to specifically raise?
Well, just the whole, the macro level working well. I have an issue with the democracy, picturing rupture as part of democracy. Because I think a society where you would have a majority of people who would vote for carrying out a ruptural change, there'd already be, that would be a very different society than societies than like our society right now, where people are already experimenting in different sorts of interstitial or whatnot things. And I think the tendency would be to continue to develop the interstitial and the symbiotic to a new point of stability, at which point then you could like take down what doesn't exist. Because if you have that much support and you are experimenting new things, you're in a really good place to keep doing that until you bump upon those limits that you can't fight anymore, or that you can't fight interstitially and symbiotically. So, and that would make the trough, like when it happened, better.
Okay, so Catherine has just made the proposal, the following argument. If you had a democratic capitalist political system, a liberal democratic capitalism, in which it was the case that a large majority of the population would be prepared to elect a ruptural socialist party to power. That is, they would elect such a party that has a declared purpose, rupture. If that were the case, that would be a society in which people would prefer to engage in interstitial and symbiotic strategies until those strategies had played themselves out, and only then do a rupture, so that it wouldn't actually ever propose a rupture until such time as the transition trough would be navigable.
Until you've built up the institutions that, like the institutions that you don't like about capitalism, they're dominating, that reinforce domination, are weakened because you've built up alternative institutions that work better through social means. Mm-hmm. And that would weaken the trough. Or like lessen the trough too.
But is the reason why a democratic party, a party that was committed to democracy and to socialism, would not engage in a rupture, is the reason because they know that the transition trough would be too big, would be impossible to traverse unless all these other things were done first? And therefore, they wouldn't embark on a rupture. So in that case, it's just supporting the argument of this chapter, because it's saying, yeah, they've read the chapter, so to speak, and that's why they would do these other things. Or is it that they, or are you making an argument that there's actually a preference for interstitial and symbiotic and non-ruptural transformations, and they would prefer, it's an active preference for that kind of change, not because of knowledge about the transition trough, but because of a preference for some other way of doing things.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and it's that overlap with when you have large support for large amounts of change. I think it's clear that the role that capital is playing isn't as limiting, or you wouldn't have been able to have that broad support. And so the immediacy of having to rupture that is less, and then the insecurity of going through, of collapsing structures is a lot distracting pizza.
Sorry, I don't know how to do this in the least disruptive way possible.
We're doing a variety of experiments in this class. One is to see if we can combine different activities without sufficient distraction that we lose our intellectual focus.
Anybody else, please?
So yeah, it's more that rupture seems necessary when the power of capital is limiting you, and you have broad support to that extent. It seems like even if you're embarking on a long-term ruptural, it's not capital that's... If you have that much support, capital's not playing the same role in your progress.
I mean, the usual argument for ruptural transformation is that although you have enough power to capture the levers of the state, you don't have enough power to seriously erode the power of capital in the economy unless you directly attack capital. So the argument for breaking with the capitalist class, with nationalizing the banks, with dispossessing the owners of the means of production, taking over corporations, the argument for that is that if you don't do that, your other attempts at slower, more incremental transformation will ultimately unravel. So that even if you have a very broad popular base sufficient to gain state power, you won't be able to maintain power unless you successfully break the power of capital. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the premise of this kind of
and that
strategy.
Can only happen with rupture.
Well, the ruptural argument is that you can't erode it over time. You have to erode. You have to erode it through frontal attack at some point. The question is, what are the strategic windows of opportunity for that? That's an additional.
Yeah, even if it's not like a developed country, in Chile, all the discussion, like main discussion, was about private property. So, I mean, even if you could do some changes in other spheres. Like the question that was behind all the government, the socialist government measure was, okay, when are they going to interrupt with private property? When are they going to nationalize or make collective property? And I think in a developed country that would be the same question from the banks, the industry, like, okay, you can do all the experiments you want, but when are you going to present a law to the Congress that will finish with private property? Maybe. I don't know if that would be the breaking point of the change.
Why don't we turn to Ricardo's interrogation. And Ricardo, what you should do is sort of briefly summarize whichever aspects of your interrogation you would like to enter into the discussion.
Well, my question was about the method that you use to analyze this strategy. Because it seems to me kind of an abstract method. More concretely, there are three or four questions about that method. This method is based on the analysis of what happens to a median person after the breaking point of the rupture. I was thinking about I was wondering about what does it mean with this medium person. How can you establish an average between all of the different situations that there are in the society to establish an average man. How do you think that you can establish an average between a salaried worker and an employer or a small owner? The same I was thinking about the consciousness and the organization of these people. How can, if in a society you have a lot of different situations about how groups are organized and how people is conscious about the social situation, how can you establish an average between all of them? And the ultimate, the final question was about this abstract average, but between the material interest of the individuals and the material interest of a group. I was thinking, for example, about salaried worker. His individual interest may be to compete with the other workers to get a job, but the material interest of all the group of salaried workers is not to compete among them, but to get together to establish better conditions for all. So how can you establish an average between those situations? That's all.
Okay. The last question, that is the relationship between the interests of individuals and something we can call a group interest, I think is a different kind of question from the other two. So let me put that third one aside to begin with. We can return to that. Let me just explain what the logic of this strategy is. I agree that it's an ahistorical strategy. The point is to create a kind of thought experiment that simplifies the problem in some drastic way, and then to see if this simplification actually helps us understand the dilemmas that political parties and activists would actually face when they would attempt such a strategy. Now, I wanted to simplify this in a way that would actually make it easier to have a rupture, not harder. So, for example, when I introduced in the second part of the chapter the distinction between workers and capitalists, of workers and middle class, that is, I went from a single class model, just the electorate, you know, the median person in the society, to two classes, that's making it more complicated. And what I think I tried to show is that a rupture becomes less likely, becomes harder. The transition trough becomes a harder problem to get through when you have two classes of non-capitalists than if you had just one. And that's because you now have the additional problem of how do you keep the coalition together, not just how do you keep individuals affiliated to the project. And the coalition may be harder to keep together because defections from the coalition may be to the advantage of some coalition members over others. Now, the reason I picked a median was, I think, simple. There's other ways you could do it, but the assumption was that there's a political party that's been elected by a majority of the population, a majority of the electorate. Employers and capitalists are a tiny part of the electorate, so we don't have to worry about them as voters. We have to worry about them for other reasons. And the median person means that's the person right at the 50th percentile within this, the distribution of outcomes of this process. So 50% of the people do worse, have standards of living worse than this median person, and 50% do better. If when the median declines, it means that at least half the population have their standards of living declining. And since you need a majority of the population to support the party in order for it to stay in power, this was meant to capture what a problem that's potentially occurring within the electoral base of the party. That if the median person in the electorate has their standard of living going up, then the proportion of the population who is benefiting from the strategies of the party is going to be larger than needed to elect the party. Right? So, I mean, that's why I picked the median person. This is part of a general theory of voting, which I don't, in fact, think is a very good one. The median voter theory, which says that political parties have to pay attention to that person in the middle because that's the cut point for the 50% given a majoritarian electoral system. I mean, that's a very big simplifying assumption, but it should be a simplifying assumption that makes it easier, not harder, to imagine traversing a rupture. It should be easier on the assumption that we don't have to worry about stratification, we don't have to worry about all sorts of different interests that come into play and have to be juggled as well. If we just assume that there's only one dimension that has to be captured, that is a simplification that I think would work in favor of a ruptural strategy, not against it. And if a ruptural strategy is not very plausible, even under favorable conditions, then of course it's less plausible under unfavorable conditions. That's why, for example, I assume that there's not going to be an armed insurrection of the bourgeoisie, right? I've assumed that all that we have to worry about is the economic dislocation of a transition. There's no civil war, there's no attempted coups, there's no revolt of the military. None of those problems, which we know historically are certainly likely to happen, I've abstracted from those. And that's because I think to say that it's costly to have a transition to socialism because of civil war is cheating in a way. It's too easy an answer to the question why you can't have a ruptural change to say, well, the military's going to block it. I do think, in fact, that would be an additional problem. I think that the issue of repression is a real one, and it makes it even less likely that under conditions when the alternative to a rupture is continuing along in a fairly wealthy capitalism that is doing sort of okay for most people's lives, that option will be preferable than the risks involved with a rupture. I think the military part makes it even more true, but I...
Yeah, but for example, if you include the risk of civil war or military, then you could have positive outcomes in the loyalty and the of voters to the party and to the project, maybe, or maybe not. But I mean, I'm also in the line of this abstracting method. I mean, you are excluding some variables because they would, in fact, be against the possibilities. But maybe it's the case that when you include them, at the end, you have a favorable outcome for the ruptural strategy.
Well, then you'd have to, I mean, this would then be an opportunity to articulate that argument. So what is this came up in one of the, maybe more than one of the interrogations in my comments. What would be a scenario, give me an argument for how an escalation of a transition into a military conflict makes it more likely to succeed, not less likely. As what would be, you can tell, I just want a story, you know, it doesn't have to be a strong theory. What's the scenario by which provoking a reaction of the military makes it easier, not harder? In a developed capitalist country, remember I specify that this is the problem of ruptural transition in in the developed capitalist countries, in those, in that part of the world. I'm not talking about everywhere.
I think under the assumption, if you go by classical assumptions like those of Marx, that there will be some sort of violent counter-revolution regardless of your own strategy, if your end goal is openly stated to be appropriation of, you know, the property rights of the capitalist class, then you will have some sort of violent reaction against you. If you assume that it's the military and you believe that you engage in a revolt first in such a way that you have a chance of splitting the military and bringing some to your side, since the class locations of military personnel is such as it is, then maybe. Otherwise, I can't think of anything even remotely.
Or unless if it's in terms of like mass support, like if you have like a small group, if there's like general unrest in a capitalist state, like heightened fiscal vulnerability, and there's just a small really revolutionary group that engages in a military, you know, coup of sorts, and most of the people just don't really know where they stand, they're scared of revolution, but, you know...
But that's not democratic.
Right, that, what's not
that, that violates our condition of democratic transition.
Okay, I guess. Well, but if it's one incident that then generates mass support for a democratic...
Were you finished on it?
Yeah.
It may be instances like that that actually serve the purpose of rupture, because sometimes you're asking people to basically pick a side, and they have to figure out where their loyalty are. Do they want to stay with the capitalists, or are they going to look at other workers and, you know, their neighbors back home and see what they're doing and say, no, perhaps, perhaps, you know, I need to choose my side. But Venezuela, I think, is a good example of what happened, and what led to the first attempted military coup in 92 was, in fact, the Caracazo, which was the uprising in the streets against neo-imperialist economic policies. But so the military was asked to turn their guns and turn tanks on their own people, on their neighbors, on their family, and that made so many people in the military turn and say, no, we want an alternative, we don't want these people in power when they tell us to, you know, turn our guns on our friends. So it created a break within the military, which led to a military attempted coup, which Chavez led in 92, which kind of became the momentum which led to real democratic change in the end, or a democratic election of Chavez.
And just like heightened awareness, like some, like an incident in like one small place that doesn't really possess the ability to like make any sort of change can just create awareness in other areas where there's not that, like, where that sense is. I don't know.
I mean, I guess it's not inconceivable, but it's hard for me to imagine in Western Europe or the United States a scenario that would look anything like that, that would be a way of enhancing the possibility of a ruptural transformation.
But no. Ruptural transformation is so hard to imagine it under the inner states to begin with, that
but even
this just adds another layer of implausibility.
Well, that's my view, is that the problem of coercion has another layer of implausibility, but Rudolfo's counter-argument was that perhaps the resort to repression by either the state or part of the state could itself trigger a level of solidarity in support of a transition that it would make a rupture more likely, not less likely. Mm-hmm. And I see that in the context of fragile states, which are not deeply institutionalized, which don't have, you know, this kind of thick civil society and, you know, the Gramscian weak state, you know, hypothesis. I can see that occurring, that repression leads the system to explode in the face of ruling classes. But I don't...
Well, if you have a society that's extremely solidaristic and a portion of it engages in some Gandhian, very provocative nonviolence and is repressed, if in the way that Molly and Charity were describing, that provokes sort of empathetic uprising in such a way that is overwhelming for the military, right? The military couldn't conceivably put down a large mass of the United States population or any country's population. What's hard to imagine is that you would have the solidarity necessary in order to have that level of uprising to begin with.
Well, the following I can imagine, although it's still, you know, it's a stretch, that is, if we had a mass solidaristic movement for social change and social justice that was large enough to elect a radical government, right? Because that's what a mass movement would accomplish, that under those conditions, the repressive apparatus might be very hesitant to launch a major repressive counteroffensive against this movement, precisely because the people within the repressive apparatus are ordinary people. You know, it's the generals may not be, but the ordinary soldiers are. And it's possible that they wouldn't be confident that they would be able to actually execute it. So the repressive threat might actually fade. That's certainly possible. That then just leaves my transition trough problem. That's the benign assumption I'm making when I draw these graphs, that I say, let's assume that the military doesn't engage in some repressive reaction to this threat, that we only have to worry about the threat from capital itself, from its own responses, given its own control over its own resources. So that's possible, but it's, of course, what's more likely is that the repressiveness of the state with respect to the social movements that would be the raw materials of this broader solidarity would be the repressiveness of the system directed at those would be increasing continually throughout the years of build-up to this mass solidaristic event that we're talking about. Just as we had anti-communism in the United States in the 1950s, which completely disrupted the left for a decade or so. So it's more likely that you would get all sorts of repressive acts.
Covert repressive acts.
Yeah, and overt, people getting arrested, put in jail, deported.
On that note, uplifting note, would anybody like more pizza?
I do.
Okay.
On the third point that Ricardo raised about collective interests versus individual interests, I'm not quite sure. I'm not sure exactly what that means in the context of the problems being raised here. That is, if it's the case that the individual standards of living of people are declining severely because of the disruption of a transition to socialism, that's the assumption of my transition trough. Well, if people don't care about their own individual standards of living very much, if all they care about is the future collective power of workers, what that means is that they individually have interests in the collective power of workers. It's still their individual relationship to that collective interest that would be guiding their response, for that to override a transition trough that was deep and prolonged implies that people have very, very robust and durable commitments that do not get eroded under this kind of disruption to a future collective power of workers, because the collective power of workers will only become a reality and stable if that transition is successful. And I think that's a pretty strong expectation to imagine that workers, given all of the uncertainties about what the future holds and the fact that during a period of disruption when life for them and their families are getting worse in material terms, there are also political parties saying, see, this is what happens when you try to embark on socialism. See, if you return to capitalism, the suffering of your family will be reduced, that a large majority of the population would continue to have confidence in the predictions about the collective power that would result from staying the course and not abandoning it. You know, so I don't deny that people have in their own values and concerns and beliefs that they care about collective interests, not just individual interests. The question is, for how long and under what conditions would they have confidence that sacrificing their individual well-being for this collective ideal is actually sacrificing it for good purpose, as opposed to sacrificing your individual interests and the collective interest isn't going to be successful anyway. Charity.
This is kind of speculative, but one thing we need to keep in mind is we'll never know what will be capital's reaction, right? And if we look again at the Venezuelan case, a lot of people told me, you know, even after Chavez came to power, was democratically elected, they weren't politicized until it was that capital said, we're going to do a national strike. And they did almost a three-month strike over the period over the holidays. And people told me it was this experience of, like, you know, of having to learn to count on their neighbors and live together, and seeing, too, what capital was capable of, meaning stopping the distribution of milk for babies, oil, you know, and this is, again, during holiday celebration where they celebrate all December. So there's also that little, you know, the element to all this about what will be capital's reaction and then what will be the people's reaction to capital's reaction, because they could also, I think, reinforce a ruptural transformation depending upon what they do. And I think in this case, people saw what they were capable of and where, when it comes down to what capital's interests really are. So there are always those possibilities. We're always talking about what we're going to do and what the people interested in socialism are going to do, but there's also those kind of hidden factors that may contribute.
Right. Now, what would you think? What do you think the situation would have been in Venezuela if there was no oil revenues? That is, the Venezuelan state had access to a source of surplus because of the global value of this resource, which meant that the transition trough wasn't catastrophic. I mean, there were disruptions, but still, there was this particular solution to that problem. Mm-hmm. Suppose...
At that time, PDVSA was just nationalized during this period, so this was all happening at once, and that was... One of the main things that kicked off this. But as people report to me, during this two-month period, they weren't getting supplies from the state. They weren't getting extra oil from the state. I mean, maybe this contributes to their forethought of,
right,
we have an alternative with resources.
Right.
So maybe in that way, you're absolutely correct that the Venezuelan case does not serve as a broad example for other places. But I think, you know, but people weren't receiving resources at that point. It was just, this was, the same thing was happening where they were just taking over those resources. So people weren't getting heating oil from the state. People weren't getting extra milk or food.
Do nationalizations count as partial ruptures? I mean, because the obvious response here is that this isn't a rupture, not a broad rupture. There's no, I mean, there might have been a temporary trough associated with these sort of social conflict, but it wasn't there were, other than the oil sector, there was no alteration of property rights, right?
Well, but that's, we described a sectoral rupture as
either nationalization needs to be accounted for in this, because obviously nationalization of an entire sector is possible. It's happened several times in the last few years, not in Bolivia. In which case, that's a big problem, or it doesn't qualify as a rupture.
Yeah, so
well, no,
the Venezuelan case is one where there's a particular move in a particular sector, but it's announced this is part of a plan for a system-level rupture. And there are other things that are going on that indicate that perhaps it is. There's skepticism about it, but perhaps it is. There's urban land reform. There's other moves that have the character of challenging existing relations. Many people are skeptical about this. They are skeptical that, in fact, even if there's the Bolivarian Revolution is the name of this, that, in fact, it's a consolidation of a variant, but not a system difference kind of system, and it isn't actually going to develop further. That's an open question, but I think there would be reasons to believe that that all these could be early stages in a ruptural strategy. The constitutional reforms that were proposed certainly had the character of wanting to break with prior institutions, not necessarily in the way that would make them more democratic. I mean, arguably, those constitutional reforms would have made the system less democratic.
It depends which reform you're talking about. It's very complicated.
Yeah, the elements of the reform that concentrated power in the hands of a president for life.
Perhaps, but that was just one piece. There's other pieces to institute popular power and to create the new system that broke from the colonial way of looking at the state and looking at the nation to more localized power systems.
Right, so it was mixed.
It's just not simple. Yeah.
So then, I mean, how do you account for this then? Because it seems anomalous on the perspective laid out here. Even as a partial rupture, you're saying that this theory of impediments to rupture is meant to apply, we talked about earlier, not only to total ruptures but to partial ruptures.
Well, and to develop capitalist countries, the median person in Venezuela is poor. The United States is a very unequal society, but Venezuela is a different story. It's in a different structure altogether with respect to the issue of the life conditions of life of the masses of the population and how that would relate to different strategic possibilities.
Didn't the British nationalize the banking system and the oppression? I think that was.
Well,
I'm just trying to think of examples of nationalizations of whole sectors in developed countries.
Well, they just quasi-nationalized one firm recently in the financial crisis a few months ago.
Yeah, but it's one thing to nationalize collapsing firm. Ricardo, do you have any follow-up?
I keep wondering about this thing of the median person because, I find difficult to understand is why a moment of rupture when the characteristic of the society in that moment is to be split between people who want to change the society and people who is opposed to that change. It's a moment when society is broken in two parts. How can you analyze that kind of moment thinking about the medium person, it's hard for me to understand because that kind of method implies to skip a lot of problems to the strategy.
What the diagram is meant to illustrate is the nature of the difficulties that individual persons in such a ruptural context face. So by identifying the fate of the person that's in the middle of the distribution of material conditions, by describing this problem in terms of that point in the distribution, it's not meant to constitute a complete description of the transition process, but rather to say, in order to make a transition, you have to somehow organize your politics and your strategies in such a way that in spite of the fact that most people's standards of living will drop a lot, they will remain in support of the transition process. The reason for pegging this to the median is just to highlight the fact that the majority of the population has to maintain its support of the rupture in order for the rupture to succeed under democratic conditions. Now that's the question I'm asking is, can a ruptural process survive under democratic conditions, given that most people's standards of living are going to go down for a significant period during that process? Now, if it is not true that most people's standards of living go down, then this particular problem doesn't occur. Other problems might occur, but this one doesn't occur. I think in advanced developed capitalist countries, if a rupture is going to be embarked on, it will be the case that most people's standards of living will decline for a considerable period of time. That's a prediction I'm making about the future. If there is a ruptural strategy under developed capitalist conditions, most people's standard of living will go down. And the most is captured by looking at the pathway of the median. That being said, it is still the case that an actual rupture will have many different groups. There'll be splits between people opposed and people in favor. There'll be some people whose standards of living will go up. It's possible that the very poorest part of the population will have an immediate improvement, because whatever else a ruptural strategy for socialism will do, it'll provide health care and basic housing for the most desperate parts of the population. So there will be different fates under this trajectory, and lots of conflicts occurring as well. I don't think that those additional features undermine the problem that's mapped in this particular set of graphs.
Yeah, I mean, how would you relate this to inequality? For example, you are taking material interest as monthly income that would allow you to buy some services and some goods, maybe. But how inequality plays in this scenario? Because inequality, even if the median person's capacity to buy things might go down, inequality will also go down.
Right.
So does it modify in any?
No, people care about inequality, and people care about their own consumption and standard of living. They care about both. So people care about their relative income as well as their absolute income. So if inequality declines a lot and people care about it a lot, that will make the decline of their own standard of living less of a problem, because it's compensated for by something else that they care about. And that could be a sufficient
force to mean that the transition trough isn't a problem. It could be. If people cared enough about the equality problem per se, and that problem was improved during a transition, then the bite of the disruption in the lower standard of living might not, in fact, undermine the coalition for the transition. I think that's not a very likely scenario, given the uncertainties that people face. Remember that throughout this process, what's going to happen in the future is a prediction by the contending political forces. It's not. The whole problem would be much simpler if everybody was certain what these curves look like. You know, I think people might well be prepared to weather a quite long and profound trough if they were absolutely unshakably confident that you'd come out of it and it would rise. So if people really believe that in their hearts, then I think the transition problem would be much, much simpler.
Confidence is inversely proportional to the length of the trough. Eric, it seems like in our discussion, we started with one premise that said we have no guarantee that the future of capitalism will entail increasing a crisis of increasing magnitude. And from there, we went on to consider conditions for structural transformation without any crisis conditions whatsoever. And I think that, I mean, at least as far as I can imagine, I can't even imagine the conditions for structural transformation, except unless we're talking about a sectoral rupture, without pretty severe crisis to begin with. In which case, the nature of the consideration of the trough becomes pretty different, because the economy has taken a pretty severe downturn as it is. It would have to be severe enough to really shake people's confidence in the system itself for them to want to engage in a ruptural transformation. And it's likely that a scenario like what happened in Argentina will happen, where factories will be empty, workers may take them over, and then you have the opposite of a transition trough. You have people seizing capital and then almost immediately improving their own conditions, at least in some isolated parts. So it seems like a crisis complicates that.
Yeah, and also I would like to add to Ido's comment that in contemporary, in at least if you think in the US, the outcome of a war would also make a crisis more likely. Like for example, in Iraq now, it didn't come out as a complete crisis of the system in the US, but it could have been, yes. I mean, under other, or maybe, I'm not so, but I mean, it could have been maybe in the future that a war is together with economic crisis and like makes this transition so different, at least, I don't know.
I have a cousin who is still a member of a small Maoist political semi-party, it's a political party, and his theory of the future is that there will eventually be a nuclear war, and that's the condition under which socialism will triumph. You know, so I
and then we just have to pray for nuclear war.
So to inform my strategy of action.
So my general view about these things is it is certainly true that there could be some parameter-changing process like massive warfare that destroys states and completely disrupts the repressive capacity of developed capitalist countries. Something like that could happen. And under those conditions, I think all bets are off. It's not at all obvious how to theorize the constellation of forces and the range of possibilities. I would think a much more likely outcome from some devastating war would be a massively authoritarian and repressive dissolution of any democratic remnant under, in a kind of mafia neo-feudalism, sort of a
a cyber technic called neo-feudalism is a more likely outcome than
Terminator.
Yeah, with Darth Vader. The Darth Vader solution is more likely.
Well, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger is now the governor of the state of California. We're part of the way there. But can I say something important? Because this is sort of my comment. And I mean, so this is a chapter about strategy, right? But part of what's entailed is what are the conditions under which the strategy would work? And so we're talking about, well, classically, and as far as any of us can now imagine, a revolution or a ruptural strategy seems to presuppose that there's some sort of crisis. And so that leads to sort of well-meaning leftists, sort of ourselves, sort of hoping for massive crises in which millions of people lose their jobs and there's massive wars and nuclear devastation. And obviously, that's really dumb. We shouldn't be hoping for those sorts of things, right? But
unfortunately, the degree to which you hope for these things will have zero effect on whether they will come about.
Unless you decide to act.
You can have whatever malevolent hopes you want
by developing a nuclear bomb and replacing it. But anyway.
This conversation is going over the internet. It's almost listening.
I was just kidding.
My comment was, I mean, so we don't really choose whether or not massive crises are going to happen, and what we think about whether or not they're going to happen doesn't affect whether or not they're going to happen. But it just seems to me, you know, I mean, most of us, other than yourself, and I apologize, but are 20s or 30s, and we have a roughly probably 50-year politically active sort of life ahead of us, right? And let's hope. And it seems to, and I feel like sort of Nostradamus or somebody's saying this, but it just seems, I mean, given some of the things that are going on in the world now, and I would mention specifically impending peak oil, impending water scarcity, I've said all this before, but also impending global realignment, where something has to happen to the fact that the hegemonic center of the global economy is massively indebted to the rest of the world, and nobody can think of a scenario in which that unwinds itself gradually. And it just seems, you wouldn't want to predict a, let's say, 10-year depression in the next 50 years, but you wouldn't want to assume that away either. And if there is a 10-year depression, let's say that's the kind of, let's say it's an intense 10-year depression. It's something that we think, you know, then we're no longer talking about this kind of scenario, but we're talking about something else. If that's likely to happen, what do you do, right? So the three things are, either something worse is going to happen, we're going to have the techno-feudal, cybernetic, dictatorial, whatever, or we're going to have something that's roughly the same, or we're going to have something better. And it's not implausible to say, well, if you find yourself in the middle of a 10-year intense depression, actually what you want to be really doing is working to preserve democracy and capital rights, because if you don't do that, you're going to get something worse, right? But that's one possible strategy. But the other strategy is, well, no, you know, if you don't work really hard to get some real utopian design in place in that period of time, well, then you're going to get Arnold Schwarzenegger and all that stuff. So I just, it seems like the conversation about the crisis conditions is sort of informed by this, well, should we hope for them or should we not hope for them? And as you're saying, it doesn't matter whether we hope for them or not, and we can't predict it, but, you know, I think, I mean, again, taking the sort of 50-year time span as kind of maybe what we should be thinking about, it seems, you know, so remiss not to think about that possibility, because it's not improbable. I don't say it's likely, but it's not improbable either.
It's certainly the case, I think, that what we can predict with certainty is that there will be very disruptive crises from time to time. We can't predict how deep or how prolonged there will be. That seems to me too contingent upon both the balance of forces in particular times and places, and the capacity for far-sighted and innovative problem-solving on the part of elites, which sometimes they are myopic, you know, idiots, and sometimes they're adept in figuring out strategies out of jams. And that's seems to be something we can't predict. So the question then is, what can we do? How should we think about the strategic problem with respect to social empowerment, if one is accepting my broader sort of democratizing the world perspective on socialism? How should we think strategically now about the unpredictable predictability? As we don't know when or how long, but we know some things will happen. What those historical moments do are create windows of opportunity, but not for everything, just for some things. Should we think of our strategic universe as one of looking for the opportunities for symbiotic transformations when those windows of opportunities occur? Or should we be preparing now for the possibility of launching ruptural transformations when those opportunities occur? Or could we do both?
Well, I think those two conditions, the uncertainty and maintaining democracy, I think really intuitively propel you to the pluralistic strategy of using all three whenever each one is appropriate. I think I think that conclusion rests on those two conditions, and so that insofar as those two conditions hold, we must use all three strategies as simultaneously as we can, pull it off.
But then I think the hesitation with that, that's the kind of ecumenical view. The hesitation with that view, I think, is whether maintaining the real potential to engage in ruptural strategies undercuts your ability to engage in symbiotic ones. That is, it may not be the case that the kinds of organizations, the kind of political movements that you support and don't support, the kind of political process that you unleash when you entertain certain possibilities, it's not necessarily the case that you can just mix and match. This is just a menu that you can have in your collective consciousness. Because what you have to do to make possible ruptural strategies when those opportunities occur, the what you have to do part may distract from, undermine your ability to engage in the sort of symbiotic strategies. Because symbiotic strategies require not just solidarity among the socially disempowered population that is attempting to expand the spaces of social power. It does require collaboration with elites. That's part of what that's the whole dilemma of symbiotic strategy. That is, you have to be trustworthy partners in a problem-solving endeavor in order for a symbiotic strategy to work. And it's both its danger and its potency. There's an observation I've made, which is partially a function of the television screen, which is that because the television screen is that way, I'm oriented in that direction.
And we participate.
And as a result, I think, part of what evokes people's desire to talk and enter is, regardless of what inner spirits people have as to how much they want to talk, it's partially whether they feel they're being welcomed. No, but they're welcomed in in the conversational mode of a seminar. And normally, without this gravitational asymmetry from the south, I'm, perusing everybody and be sure I get your eye and see if you've got that little pre-wanting to talk agitation in your body language. And I'm clearly not fully attentive to that. All of that was a kind of poetic
way of putting,
yeah.
Them
saying,
on the spot.
Yeah, so you guys haven't, at this end of the table, you haven't intervened in our discussion, and I want to encourage you to do so, not bully you into doing.
All right. Okay,
That was a general invitation. You're next. You're number three on the list, so you're going to get your moment in it, whether you like it or not. Yeah.
Okay. My probably question or criticism is different than you guys. I'll accept everything you say.
with it. I'll believe all your assumptions. My only question is about how Shaborsky fits in your frame. I agree with the assumption that a ruptural strategy is possible only through representative democracy. However, I don't understand if we're able to elect a socialist government in country A, how country B, country C will agree with that. It seems that the case of the way Shaborsky brings this argument is it's purely a game theoretic argument. It's kind of an ideal type, and it doesn't have kind of the it doesn't have the power to explain relationship between countries. Or do you understand what I'm getting at?
It's definitely a state-centered argument, thus a national argument. That is, his argument is about his assumption is that a transition to socialism in very crucial ways involves actions of states, not just of individuals and groups, but states are pivotal because of the importance of property rights and the enforcement of property rights and the transformation of those rights. So even if in some ultimate sense the dissolution of nationally bounded states that is part of the goal of a socially empowered world, perhaps, nevertheless, the site for such transitions and transformations have to be states. And that's why it has that state-centered focus. And he does abstract from the problem, as I do, of military intervention from other states, as well as
International conflict in general.
And international conflict, right. But the question is, do those when thinking about these as strategic pathways, do those considerations change our conclusions about the nature and plausibility of these different strategies? Does the fact that individual states are embedded in a global system make ruptural strategies more or less plausible as a strategy? Do they make the transition troughs deeper or shallower?
Probably not. It raises, but the international conflict question is still on the table. And what I think we lose is in the first chapter we talked in terms of the global, at the level of the global unit of analysis, saying, it was a universalistic practice that is the real utopia. Everyone should have access to this. And now we kind of shifted gear. I very much agree with what is in this chapter, but I don't see why you don't have any interest in kind of engaging the interstate relation or problems.
I guess I don't see how one would do it. That is how.
Well, you don't have to engage it, but you just have to acknowledge it.
I have a question that relates to that, especially if you really succeed in building like a socialist party, really takes office in the United States, for example. we are talking about affluent countries and so.
We're not laughing about the idea of it taking office, we're laughing about the idea of there being a socialist party.
Let's assume there is a socialist party in the U.S.
Wait, Brock isn't it?
How that would affect the world? I mean, because we know that anything that changes in the U.S. now affects every single country in the world. So maybe it will be easier for socialism to become possible in the world if this change happens in the U.S. If you think like the international approach that Guillaume is proposing, because actually any single measure that you take here affects some in like usually in negative ways in the world. So
if a socialist transformation of any of these varieties ruptural, interstitial, or symbiotic, or some combination, is to occur somewhere in the world. I would think among the last places it will occur is the U.S. It's much more likely, I'm talking in the developed world. I mean, it's a whole separate set of issues as to what happens when these transformative projects are attempted in third world contexts. So far, in third world contexts, they have not resulted in robust social power. That the attempts at doing so have always been transformed into authoritarian statism. That's the historical record. So that robust social power has not been in equilibrium. When these transformative projects are launched under low productivity conditions, basically. Now that could change, and I don't mean to think of that as a law, you know, some sort of natural law of social decay, but that's been the historical experience. In the developed world, if it were to occur, it's going to occur in the places that have the most advanced democracies with the most developed welfare and social justice agendas, in which the move towards a more socially empowered form of those solutions, of those systems, become solutions to various kinds of problems and natural extensions of, you know, tendencies that are already there. I think it'll occur through interstitial and symbiotic transformations that hit tipping points that then change the reproductive qualities of the system, but if ruptural strategies became possible, they would have a much better chance of accomplishing such transformations there. And the United States' role will be primarily to make that difficult. You know, so we'll be a negative force with respect to that process because of our global role. But it just doesn't seem plausible that the United States could be a leading force for that.
So I'm wondering, because we always, when we talk about some developing countries, you focus on developed. So I said, okay, let's talk about the most developed one and see what happens.
I have a couple different questions. So I want to pin down this developing country issue, because earlier we said, well, no ruptures, at least limited ruptures, are possible. We've seen a couple in the past few years with nationalizations of various sectors. So it seemed like you said before that you can have ruptures, possibly not just limited ruptures, but entire ruptures in developing contexts, and I can think of a couple reasons why that might be more plausible. And then, so if that is in fact possible, but then you just said sort of something that was sort of different, which was that every time it's been tried, it's resulted in authoritarian
statism.
But it doesn't seem like we have, other than maybe Allende, we don't have many examples of where sort of real utopian things have been tried as opposed to statist.
No, in both China and Russia, real utopian things were tried, and they just and I don't believe the motivations and ideologies of the revolutionaries engaged in those struggles was from the start committed to, you know, centralized police states. That wasn't.
But they didn't have democratic ruptures.
Right. They had ruptural strategies, but they didn't have ruptural strategies that used democratic means. But my argument for the necessity of using democratic means, that is, using the existing democratic forms, there's two branches to that argument. One is, in the developed liberal democracies, that's the only plausible way that you could possibly do it. That is an armed insurrection against the representative and democratic constitutions of these societies has zero chance of ever succeeding. I can't imagine that, except, you know, under some cataclysmic background conditions where I can't imagine anything. Right? So it has to work through those institutions, because any alternative leads to complete marginalization. That's one argument. And the other argument, which might apply also to less developed countries, is that an armed insurrectionary strategy, that is a strategy that does not work through democratic processes, is extremely unlikely to produce a democratic outcome. That's an argument that applies more generally, not just in the... Now, the context in which that argument becomes less compelling is when it's
when you're struggling against a dictatorial authoritarian state to begin with. Right, so if you're in a context where there is no democratic root, the only roots are outside of those institutions. You still, of course, have decisions between nonviolent and violent protests. There's certainly historical examples of nonviolent mass movements against authoritarian states. That's possible. But I'm not speaking really to the case of how do you engage in a ruptural strategy for a democratic goal under dictatorial states.
But I'm saying, take for example the country like Mexico, where you have a nominally democratic regime, but you have a large. This is about sort of the transition Trump issue, right? That you, in a place like that, you have a large enough impoverished population, either people who are basically now surviving on the informal economy or subsistence agriculture, that it's not unreasonable to think that you're getting up towards the median voter. You know, given some crisis, reasonably strong crisis conditions and things like that, you're actually getting to a point where a large chunk of the population would not necessarily be in a very deep transition trough, if any at all, because they're already so close to this threshold where it's not the capitalist economy that's sustaining them. It's family networks, it's subsistence agriculture, it's whatever.
Well, that's a context in which then the As I said, I think in this model, if there are contexts where the graphs look very different, then the outcomes could be very different. So that's a context in which it's possible that the transition trough is very shallow for a very large proportion of the population, or shallow enough, and you still have the confidence in the future problem, and they're confident enough that the outcome would be favorable. I think we should... Because we have to stop a little early due to the Michael Burvoy's lecture, I propose that we not actually take a formal break and we continue, you know, till about a quarter till, if that's okay with everybody. But I think we should move on to another one of these. Eduardo.
Well, my main problem that I have is but I don't know if it's a problem as a reader, I don't know if it's a problem of terms or definitions. At least where I'm coming from in terms of ideology, you know, in terms of background or of sort, that I always saw rupture or revolution or even utopia like kind of at the end of the process. And I think you kind of say that even when we've been talking here today, and actually it's kind of at the end of the response you sent back, that if you actually thought that you had this interstitial changes and this symbiotic changes, well then maybe you can have conditions that could make it possible for some major ruptures. And so to me that kind of makes more sense. Because when I read the chapter, it seems like at the end you're actually discarding any kind of rupture or transformation. You're saying that it's not possible. On the other hand, you say, in the response you sent to me, you said that on the other hand, if you have good interstitial change, it's kind of good. And symbiotic changes, well, then maybe some kind of metamorphosis can occur, which wouldn't necessarily... require a rupture, but the system can still be transformed, which I think sounds kind of utopian. I think that's even a harder way to see kind of the overall changes in the system. So that's what I kind of saying. Why not put this chapter at the end where you can actually say, well, if we start with this, we certainly will have these problems. This what's the word you use? Trough? I think
so. Trough.
Yeah, trough, which makes it think in ruptural strategies at this moment in time kind of not possible to be implemented. But if you put it kind of at the end, maybe there is space, as long as you relate it to these changes that are actually occurring in society that making or bringing certain conditions that can make those trough. I think that was kind of difficult. I don't know why.
Well, it's got this ridiculous spelling that comes from German.
Oh, okay.
He said one of our words that has a... Whoops, so did we lose them?
Yeah. Oh, my question was so good. Well,
I wonder why that...
Yeah, I don't know.
We're back.
It's the CIA coming in.
Yeah. Every time you say atomic bomb,
socialism.
Yeah, socialism.
They are so not threatened by us, let me tell you.
I mean, just look at Rudolf.
I mean, there are two issues that Eduardo was raising. One is a kind of editorial question: would it be better to have the ruptural transformation be at the third of the three discussed, and the other is a substantive one, whether the proper way of thinking about ruptural strategies is not as a standalone strategy, but rather as a as the culmination of one or both of the other two strategies. And I think I agree with that conclusion, and indeed the conclusion to the book, which is yet to be written, will have as one of its themes precisely that idea, that whether or not ruptural strategies are needed is something that's extremely hard to know in advance. That is, it's hard to know when we're so far away from creating the conditions of possibility for any of these transformations to really make a fundamental, profound difference. It's hard to know what the limits really are. So one view is that over a very long period of time, interstitial and symbiotic transformations do change the logic of the system as a whole. And the system just has the hybrid has a different system functioning, where capitalism is adapting then to the spaces that are allowed for it, rather than the rest of the economic structure is adapting to the spaces that capitalism permits. So if you get a system change, a gestalt shift, or a phase shift, to use other metaphors, as a result of those metamorphosis processes, then a rupture wouldn't be necessary. But on the other hand, it may be that there is some unsurmountable barrier, but at a point where the task is actually fairly modest, but it could still be an unerodible barrier. And then that would be a situation in which one could then be in the historical context for entertaining a viable ruptural strategy. I think I'm going to still keep the chapter where it is because of its historical salience in the tradition of debates around these things. So the variety of reformisms that have been discussed in history are always against the backdrop of the revolutionary option. And so I think I need to clarify that logic first. Molly, you're next on the stack.
I think all the points I brought up in my interrogation were addressed in the discussion. I actually don't have it in front of me, but
well, you do mention how there are certain constraints on ruptural transformation, even if a socialist party is, even when, under the hypothetical condition that a socialist party is elected.
Oh, yeah. You want to bring up that point?
What'd you say about it?
I guess it was just like it was just further skepticism as to the possibility of a ruptural transformation, and that, I think that this kind of has been talked about too, but just, I really can't imagine. That I guess there's just that the ability of a party, yeah, even under the most optimal conditions, to create a ruptural transformation, that there's like a, in light of the conversation on the reproduction and the that the state induces that I think would be hard just because of the processes of change. I just was doubting the ability of a party to make the changes within the state. But I think we've kind of talked about that. So I don't know.
Charity, you're next on the.
I'll try and just take two of my points and condense them to one. So I think all the assumptions that are made in these models assume that material growth is going to continue to rise. And I think that's a dangerous assumption, that we always want material growth to be on this upward curve. I mean, that's quite dangerous. So then that leads to the question too, well, we should not be talking about immaterial gain or material wealth, but in standards of living. And that is problematic in the sense of it's very relative. Standard of living can, you know, just be basic subsistence to some people and be, you know, two cars in the driveway, a TV in every room for other people. So I just think that that's something we should discuss, you know, just because it is such a relative term. And what would it mean in this case? And I just don't think that...
What do I label the vertical axis there? What
material?
I say material
welfare.
I say material welfare.
But
that's meant to be. It's meant to be a somewhat vague, but encompassing idea of the material conditions of life that people care about, that matter to them. It doesn't necessarily just mean. You know, consumption of stuff, you know, would include leisure, pollution, you know, would include all the things that are bound up with nature and its transformation that affect your life. So it's not meant to be your total welfare. I want something a little narrower than that. If you were to put, for example, on the vertical axis, you're all things considered well-being without any specification, well, then it's not so obvious that there's a transition trough, you know, because there's so many dimensions of what's going on. What we can predict is that capitalists are going to disinvest, that there's going to be disruptions of commodity chains, that credit markets are going to collapse. We can predict all of that, which means there's going to be a lot of disruption of production. So the bread and butter items on the shelf, so to speak, are going to be problematic for some period until everything gets reintegrated. So that's predictable, and that's why I use the word material in there. So it's that component of your well-being that I think there'll be a trough in. Whether it's your all things considered well-being or not is another matter. And if the other things that people care about were to improve so dramatically, so quickly, and robustly, that would be an argument against my pessimism, because it would say, well, what people really care is they're all things considered well-being, and not all these other dimensions. Life is going great, you know, crime's down, kids are playing in the street happily. I mean, all these other things that you care about have improved, maybe. I mean, I'm just saying by hypothesis. And you're feeling solidaristic and part of a community. All these things have improved. And you're not alienated in work, even if you're not getting paid very much, because you have supply interruptions, but you're not alienated, because you're in control. I mean, all of these things could weigh pretty heavily. It depends upon context.
Maybe that just needs to be somehow stated more openly. But then getting back to the standard of living idea and the idea of social harms, I think an underlying assumption of real social change is having this discussion about what standard of living means and how an improved standard of living for some means social harms for others often. So I just think those are some concepts that are always so taken for granted, but there's never real weight to what they mean. And how do we go along that with the description when we talk about, okay, we build solidarity based on material interests? We have to also talk about how what's in some people's material interests is in others' disinterest or create those social harms. So that has to be part of the movement as well, especially considering environmental state of things.
and that, but still, I mean, those are good points, absolutely. And certainly from the normative point of view as to why we might want to transform capitalism, those are precisely the kinds of considerations that explain why we want to do this. They don't necessarily, though, undermine the corrosive effect of the attempt at transformation, particularly this, through this ruptural logic, if the experience of everyday life of most people is that hardships increase during the period of transformation. You know, so if that is a pervasive experience because of this transition trough, the people who are experiencing these hardships can say, yes, the reason I supported this party is because I believed in all these wonderful things. And we'd finally be able to tackle global warming, we'd have nicer parks, and we'd work less. But for the moment, the parks are falling apart because we can't, you know, fix them. The pollution is increased because we've had to resort to
coal
rather than other things because we don't have the resources due to all this disruption to keep our to do these high-tech solutions and so on. So things are just getting worse on all those things, a lot of those things. But I'm still supporting the party because I believe we're going to come out of this. And then the next election comes around and they think, well, it's been 6 years now, we're still not seeing a major improvement. Maybe these people who say that this is an inevitable result of the destruction of markets and private enterprise are right. So the question is, how robust will be people's confidence in the face of these declines, even if they value all these other things that you correctly and absolutely correctly indicate should be part of everyone's calculation of what their interests are. And they might even agree with you. But their confidence in it, I think, will be eroded by the transition trough. Particularly if there's then heterogeneity in the population. So, we get the coalition problem.
Right.
Where the exit option from the coalition has clear advantages for some groups and not for others.
I mean, is that something how do you plan for that? How do you plan to, some people will have to make those sacrifices. I don't know.
But I think the idea is that instead of it being predetermined by your economic power, how you suffer from environmental damage, that will no longer be predetermined. Like, economic power will no longer be predetermining things like that. And so then everyone has more of an incentive to improve it.
Because it becomes a collective.
Yeah. So it's not just about putting, if you recognize you need power, it's not about just choosing to put it far away from your house. Because that's close to someone else's house.
Since we have only limited time left, Julian. Let's switch to your.
We are thinking and thinking your model a lot of time, but we find some points difficult in order to think. First, you take just one level. No? Material welfare, no? Economic.
Right.
No? Take political and cultural.
Right.
And other level. But the first question for me is why you don't make a model with a thesis before the ruptural transition. Because it's very difficult seeing that the people choose a ruptural transition without a crisis, without big problem in the society, not just economic, political, cultural, no? The history of the revolution is this, no? Social crisis. And and other levels or variables was the relation between nations, no? For example, the imperialism, no? And in this way, some point is, for example, maybe the people in the transition, no? Obviously, the crisis reduced the cost of the transition, no? But maybe the people don't have immediately better condition of life, but maybe have cultural reconnection, like the Zapatistas in Chiapas, for example, no? Or maybe redistribution of resources, no? Maybe the land, for example, no? And a promise of future recovery. Or maybe, for example, national autonomy or national independence, no? I don't know, but it is when we wanna see the historical process with the model, we find troubles. But obviously, it's a model, no?
It is obviously a model, but the model is nevertheless meant to deepen our understanding of either historical cases or historical possibilities. You know, so it can do either task. It depends upon what you're using it for. So, for example, the fact that you invoke cultural interests and conditions as a counterweight to the arguments in the model suggests that perhaps there could be cultural conditions which would counteract the effects of the transition trough that is portrayed in this model. When you invoke crisis, at least the economic side of crisis, what you're saying is that's a condition which would counteract the trough itself. The trough will not be as deep relative to the alternative, that is, not not having a transition. The trough will not be as deep under crisis conditions than under stable conditions. Now, the model serves a purpose, therefore, in clarifying both of those points, that is, as opposed to saying there's something wrong with the model itself, that is, that there is no transition trough problem. One view of ruptural change is that there is no problem of this sort. That is, it is in the immediate interest of workers not only to have socialism, but to struggle for socialism, because their immediate conditions of life will improve from the very act of transition. Well, I think that is, under certain very special historical conditions, perhaps true, but not under developed capitalist conditions. That is an incorrect view. And therefore, we must embed the notion of a ruptural strategy with respect to these other considerations, some of which you've suggested, and some of, you know, others of which we've been talking about. On the issue of the cultural conditions which could both explain why people want to transition and make it easier to survive the transition. You know, it's two things. Culture is invoked here for two purposes. One is to explain why people even embark politically on this route. Well, they do so because they're motivated by cultural concerns, not just economic concerns. And secondly, why they stay on the route. The framing, the way I've tried to frame this problem is to say, let's just assume through whatever process people embark on this route, and there's many possible stories you could tell to get people on the path, why should we believe they won't abandon it? I mean, after all, in ordinary electoral social democracy, we have plenty of examples of people voting in left-wing parties. Left-wing parties embark on a certain project that provokes all sorts of reactions, and they lose the next election. Right. So this is a Szaborski makes this point that the big problem with any serious political project is always the second election, not the first election. That there's lots of ways you can win the first election, because you're facing an idiot opposition, because the opposition divides the vote, because some historical crisis occurs that scandalizes everyone and they say throw everyone else out and you win. So there's lots of ways you can win the first election. It's much tougher to win the second election. And it's the second election problem, so to speak, that the transition trough addresses. That's what it's about. It's saying that it's going to be very difficult under democratic conditions to survive the second election if you're really challenging capitalist power, as opposed to simply engaging in a set of reforms which might make life better and which can help the system work better. Symbiotic reforms can survive the second election under some conditions. Can ruptural reforms, ruptural strategies which really are challenging the centers, the foundations of capitalist power, survive the second election? Well, maybe they could if these cultural motivations were so powerful and provided such solidarity.